cliffcentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Romani's present. How are you, Dr. Witt?
I'm okay, Mr. Kabanek. You got called Mr. Kabanek quite a lot in the last sort of week and a half.
For some reason
used as a derogatory epithet.
Well, when they were polite, they called me by my name. When they weren't, they said I was an alt-right misogynist who hated black editors.
Welcome to the largest alt-right podcast in the Southern Hemisphere.
Or in Africa, at least. Niche, I understand, but still.
We're not alt-right at all. In fact, we're not even really right. Those of you who hate us might want to go back and just listen to some shows and see where we actually do stand instead of just screaming at us on social media. Is that about right?
It sounds like a lot of work for some people who hate us.
I'm very happy because, you know, I often say that I actually don't own any land as a white male. But I've learned recently that I actually am occupying so many people's brains rent-free that I am probably one of the largest landowners in the country.
But it's vacant land. Does it still count?
that's a very good point, actually. It is quite vacant now that you come to mention. We had a big week last week. There was the Shelley Garland thing. We didn't comment on it last Tuesday because we recorded that podcast.
Yeah, way
prior.
In advance.
Yeah.
What is there to say? They found the guy. They interrogated him like he was a suspect in a murder case. he resigned. Yeah.
I'm just surprised. There were so many people very sure it was you, Ramon, and then there were a couple of people very sure it was me, and they were even promising us T-shirts.
The Broforce T-shirts.
We will be making those T-shirts. For anyone who wants them, please join the Renegade Report group on Facebook, and we'll look into an order. Hashtag Broforce.
So if you're white, it's $3.99. If you're not white, $2.99.
Yes, it seems fair.
Excellent.
I don't know if we can get shirts for $3.99.
But if
we may have to oppress some Chinese people.
Right, or Indians.
That would be very wrong.
Which one is worse on the oppression scale, Indians or Chinese?
It's a good question. Indians.
Indeed.
If we go to Pakistan, I think that will be like right there. And that's worse on the oppression Olympic scale.
And there must be children.
Well, goes without saying if they haven't all been killed by American drones. Right, so this week, given that we have the whole Shelley Garland thing that happened, that's other thing to mention is we wanted to start a Shelley rating system. It was mentioned by one of our listeners on social media. Great idea.
Right. So I still don't know. So it's a Shelley rating.
Yeah. You get a Shelley rating for being or for a website or a news provider. So, for example, currently the Huffington Post would be like a Shelley rating of like at least 4 out of 5, right? So 5 being the most fake news kind of ideology peddling stuff you can find.
The Daily Vomit type.
Daily Vomit's a 5.
Right.
Okay.
Huffy Puffy Post a 4.
Four and a half.
Right.
And then like if you have like half decent opinions, then you get closer to 2s and 1s.
Well, I think if you mention the word white and privileged together, that's already a 4.
Fair enough.
And
any mention of Marx is straight to a 5.
Right.
So we are working on a Shelley rating, just to let you know. Our guest this week, let's stop talking crap, is Mark Oppenheimer. Mark, I get your name right this time, man. Right, so...
So welcome back. You are our first guest who's come back on the show, Mark.
He's had enough psychiatry and enough sessions, and he's been in a safe space for the last 12 months, and he's back.
And it's a pleasure to be here with Wit and Witless.
Yes, someone did say that. Wit and witless. And the funny thing is, I'm wittier than him.
You're definitely the wittiest.
You can tell people don't listen to our show.
No, they don't listen at all. And I highly recommend that if this is the first time you're listening to our show, you go back to the original show we did with Mark, in which we discussed hate speech and we discussed what really constitutes hate speech as against hateful or hurtful speech. because most people just don't get it. I mean, this week we've got a painting that a lot of people don't like. You got any comments on that?
So I think Ayanda Mabula is a national treasure. I'm a huge fan. I think it takes massive balls to do what he does, and he does it time and time again.
Excuse the pun.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, I'm interested to see what the response is. I mean, he uses the similar rape metaphor that Sapiro uses. And, you know, it's his discussion about Zuma raping Mandela in this very visceral way where you can see this anguish in Mandela's eyes. And he says, you know, Mandela is all of us. And this is what's happening to us. You know, and this, you know, vicious rapist character of Zuma is perpetrating this hatred on the rest of us. And the Mandela Foundation says something quite amazing, which is that they say we respect his right to free expression. We find the piece distasteful, but we're not going to stop him from saying it. Mm. And I think that's very powerful. That's the kind of maturity you expect in a mature democracy and from good civil society.
Yeah. And the ANC releases something going, we will take this on in the courts, or consider we taking it on in the courts, at least, is kind of in their statement, which is, I don't know, irrational, given that I'm sure our constitution
it expressly
prevents them
it.
From doing that.
The right to free speech specifically talks about artistic expression. Mm. Undoubtedly, this is protected.
Well, but the ANC released a statement as well. They will use the criminal justice system.
Yeah, that was what I was referring to.
Oh, right, yeah, of course. But I don't know. It's not about the ANC, so why the fuck are they getting involved?
Well, they're protecting their dear leader, I guess.
Yes, well, there's an ANC flag in the background which is radiating onto Zuma's glistening body while he penetrates, you know, the metaphorical Mandela and the literal Mandela.
I don't know. It's just extremely... unfortunately, he's a hero, but I don't think he's a good artist.
Yeah, art's one of those subjective things, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah, a bit like taking away the vote for white men. It's very subjective, apparently. Nevertheless, Mark, you are here for a specific reason, and it is the selective, if I'm saying it correctly, selective reporting of hate speech, particularly in media. So you had a talk at Solidarity during the course of this week, which I recommend. We will link it up when we release this. But you had a 20-minute speech about what is reported on, what isn't reported on, and the repercussions. So just as a general background, what is the ambit of what you said?
So Solidarity produced quite an amazing report. What they've done is they've looked at racist speech over the year of 2016, and they've looked at a number of different instances, and then they've seen what are the repercussions of that speech. So how much press coverage was there for it, how many articles were written, and were there any sanctions for those that were, you know, producing the racist content. And they find this huge disparity. So you have, you know, Penny Sparrow having enormous amounts of coverage, having criminal sanctions against her. She has to pay a 5,000 rand fine. In the Equality Court, she's fined 150,000 rand. And there's a large number of these other instances which, you know, the press coverage is, you know, 500 and up for each person, you know, for the sort of racist thing they say. But then when you look at and these guys, so the way Solidarity's done is they've looked at white speakers and black speakers.
Is that 500 articles?
500 articles, yeah.
Wow.
So an enormous number, you know. And they say something like the average for every white speaker is something like 600 articles per person. Penny Sparrow kind of pushing that up because it's very high numbers. But even then, once you take Penny Sparrow out, the average is very high. But when it comes to black speakers... often the content of what they say is different in that it's racist, but there's also a call to action. So there's an idea that you must cut white people's tongues out, that they should be burnt alive, that they're murderers, that they slaughtered people. And then you have black speakers who are very prominent. So you have people like Julius Malema speaking at big rallies. You have the president of the country who holds a huge platform saying racist things. And you find that the number of reports on these guys is minuscule in comparison. So the number of reports about Julius Malema and anti-white speech, it's something like 160. You know, he's at the top of the black column, and the bottom of the black of the white column is something like 250 for someone complaining about beachgoers or, you know, some other such, you know, racist drivel. But so they point this out, and they say we've got a double standard. The way that they're dealt with it by the Human Rights Commission is also done through a double standard, and that's a concern. And you find it in, you know, we've talked about the hate speech bill, and that piece of legislation builds in prosecutorial discretion. So it says that Sean Abrams gets to decide whether you get prosecuted or not. Now, that kind of thing is incredibly dangerous. You know, when arbitrariness is caked into the law, that you can say, well, what you've said is a breach of the law. You know, you're inciting violence. You're saying something hateful. But we're not going to prosecute you because you're a loyal cadre of the movement. You know, but you who are on the opposition, you know, we're going to send you to jail. For the first offense, it's 3 years, and the second offense is 10 years. And those offenses are there for things like making fun of politicians and lawyers.
Yeah, so actually, we were joking about it a few minutes ago, but the ANC saying they're going to go through the criminal justice system to deal with this painting, that could be a problem if you've got someone like Sean Abrams, who's clearly close to the president, making the decision on whether it's...
Well, undoubtedly, if the hate speech bill was law, Ayanda Mabula would be rotting in a cell.
Yeah.
That's frightening to me, that the idea that you can lock up an artist. You know, of course, you know, South Africa has a history of, you know, persecuting artists. You know, during apartheid, this was par for the course, that those that disagree with you or, you know, want to make fun of you, you know, you ban them, you drive them underground, you kill them.
Sure. And even irrational things, like they banned the book Black Beauty.
Yes.
Because the horse was black and the title was Black Beauty. It was literally that simple.
And this is what worries me, is that we're sort of, you know, heading down this sort of censorial path again, you know. I mean, there's this book called The Lighter Side of Apartheid that makes fun of all these ridiculous things that were done, you know, under this awful regime. And we're starting to see more and more of this emerging now. It's very dangerous.
So when you spoke originally about the contrast between the reporting, Why is that? Because the reporting on, like, Penny Sparrow, who I keep repeating, is a nobody estate agent who no one likes. No one likes estate agents, right, Jonathan?
Nobody likes estate agents. I mean, other than lawyers. I mean, you know. Sorry, Mark. Excuse me. But
Mark's an advocate.
He's an advocate. That's all right. Advocate. So he's, well, I don't know. The advocates are earning well off Jacob Zuma. I think they might have been.
You know why God created estate agents?
Yeah.
So that lawyers would have someone to look down on.
Marvelous. All right. So yes, estate agents are not liked.
Are not liked. Penny Sparrow, least of all. But no one cares. Well, no one knows where she. Well, she's not important at all to the social welfare of this country. It was opportunistic that they found her Facebook post and they made a huge deal out of it. Why is there a difference in reporting in the media, though?
So let's talk a little bit about, as you said, this opportunism with Penny Sparrow. I mean, it's a little Facebook post. My guess is her 3.5 friends saw it. Let's look at the timing. So if we rewind back 3 weeks, okay, 9th of December, Clankley Nene gets fired, okay? The nation goes into an absolute uproar, right? There are anti-Zuma protests in the streets, outside Parliament, you know, in the city of Joburg. There's a huge Zuma Must Fall poster that's erected at the top of Long Street. You know, people are in utter disdain with the presidency, and the Rand's taken a huge beating.
Right.
And then on the 4th of January, we're talking about this estate agent from the middle of nowhere. And we all take the bait. And she ends up eating up all sorts of news media for ages. And we stop talking about corruption. We stop talking about the failing economy. And we stop talking about, you know, a president who's got 783 corruption charges against him. We talk about her. So it's undoubtedly a diversionary tactic. And the press fall for it hook, line, and sinker. I think if we do this comparison with the Shirley Garland story, you know.
Which one's that?
So, for posterity's sake, because as much as it seems like a big story now, maybe, you know, you listen in 2 years, it's going to go, who the hell, Shirley Garland?
Yes.
The article that gets written says, white men should be disenfranchised. They shouldn't be allowed to vote on the grounds that they are really the root evil behind everything. If it's, you know, if white men weren't allowed to vote, then we wouldn't have had Trump in power, we wouldn't have had Brexit, and we wouldn't have the DA running four municipalities, right?
And also world wars and a whole bunch of other stuff, which are all related to men. I remind people that they love to send that meme around of the woman who came up with a lot of the formulae to make the atomic bomb possible. They love sending that out, but when the atomic bomb gets dropped, then it's the men that were responsible entirely. It's always ironic that they don't see the hypocrisy.
Nevertheless.
So what happens is, you know, the Huffington Post sees this post and they say, well, we're going to publish it. And it's embedded in the post is a whole bunch of utterly fake nonsense. So it says 97% of the stock exchange is white owned. And there's a link supporting it. If you click on the link, it's a story debunking the claim because Zuma had said something along these lines in the State of the Nation address. So, you know, the article is, any journalist worth their salt would have realized this is a prank, okay? And They don't, because of ideological fervor, because they love the idea of having this great evil that we can blame for all of the ills, they publish the piece. And when the criticism comes in that this is a hateful piece, the idea that in a country where people fought and died for universal franchise, that it's outrageous to publish a piece calling people to be disenfranchised and blaming people on the grounds of sex and race, they double down. And Virajni Pillai writes this piece saying, but this is blindingly obvious to us. You know, this is a mainstream view.
Standard feminist theory.
Yes, this is the line, right? And she says, of course we need to dismantle this oppressive power. So then, afterwards it comes out that Shelley Garland is a nom de plume, and this is written by someone else. And their immediate line is, we've been duped, and the real story here is that there's a fake author, and we need to look at that. Now, that's not the real story. The real story is you guys published hateful content. You celebrated the amount of ad clicks that you got on it. You know, there's a picture of Sipho Ngwane saying, you know, we love the outrage we're getting because we're making so much money from this. And
paraphrasing him, of course.
Yes, yeah, paraphrasing. But there's a chart of,
yeah,
of the clicks.
He says every time we put this online, it goes crazy, and he shows the charts of all the hits they get.
Yeah, yeah. It might as well be HuffPost bank account going up. You know,
yeah,
it's sure. Directly into ad revenue.
Sure.
So it suits them to kind of have this agenda. And this is one of the things that I talk about in my speech is, you know, people that engage in race baiting are doing so for a purpose. And unfortunately for some elements of the press, it brings in revenue. You know, people love it. Yeah. People read the stories. And I think it's important to say, why are we publishing the story? Is it actually newsworthy? Are we doing this to bait a public? And the problem is that if you keep on baiting people and you keep on vilifying people, it has real world repercussions. So South Africa has a very violent history, and we marginalize people and we persecute people. If we just take ourselves back a little bit to 2008, where we have this outbursting of xenophobic violence, there's this iconic photo of a Mozambican guy called Ernesto Nomuvwe, and he's been beaten and he's been stabbed and he's being burnt alive. Now we need to think about that, you know, that the problem with genuine hate speech is that it can lead to these eruptions of violence. That once you vilify a group enough and you say these people are outsiders, they don't belong, you know, you legitimize violence against them. And the problem is that I think the press is engaging in this. Look, it's not just HuffPost. You know, I think they deserve to be, you know, sternly talking to, and they need to do some internal reflection about how they could have allowed this to happen. But there are, you know, other parts of the press that are doing this. I also talk a little bit about extremist organizations that are on the rise. So the UN's got this early warning system, and they put that at the top, that if you've got these racist organizations that are arising, that's something to look out for, so that you can stop genuine violence from erupting. And I think there's two that we should be deeply concerned about. The one being Fees Must Fall. So you might think that, trying to get education expanded for more people is a good thing. But if you look at their tactics, the way that they've mobilized is on a racist platform. That they continually talk about white monopoly capital, you know, racist white colonial institutions that need to be burned and destroyed. And they don't just say this stuff, they do it. So they burned down a science building at Northwest University.
They set fire to the library at Wits.
Yeah. They burn art, and they celebrate the burning of whiteness. So they've tied their violence acts to racist propaganda. And they've lived up to their propaganda, and they've celebrated it. You know, I mean, they kind of take this Khmer Rouge line of, once we've destroyed, you know, all of the evil colonial stuff, you know, then we can have our year zero, and, you know, from the ashes will rise the phoenix. And you say to them, tell me what the phoenix looks like, and they go, we'll work that out later, buddy. You know, shut your racist mouth. And the other guys that I'm concerned about, who are kind of wedded to Fees Must Fall, are Black First, Land First. So you have guys like Lindsay Marsdorp, you know, actively calling for, you know, white people to be killed, and he says that he loves the idea of being able to personally kill white people. And what's interesting,
he said that?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's tweeted that a few times.
Wow.
So I mean, this is a worrying thing. He's got into a physical altercation with guys from AfriForum. They've laid an assault claim against him. I've had a personal interaction with him, which is kind of hilarious as well.
That was on the last show, so you have to go back and listen to that.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
I'm as you know, I support the freedom of speech quite vociferously, but I'm just quite shocked that he has. I mean, he does hold a position of relative authority. He doesn't. It's not a greatly large party, but they get a lot of news coverage.
They do.
They're kind of like the EFF when they were first starting out. The media seems to love them.
Well, they're a breakaway, right? Because the EFF wasn't radical enough for them. They formed their own party. You know?
Sure. So he's one of the leaders in there, and I'm just quite shocked that he's sort of said something like that. I
they have banners that say land or death. You know, they celebrate this idea of violence.
It's quite shocking to hear. I once again would defend his right to say it unless he's actively engaging in violence at that point. But wow.
Yeah. So look, I mean, if we can draw this distinction between hateful speech when you've got racist content and genuine hate speech where there's a call to action. In addition to your advocacy of hatred, you're asking for violence to be visited on, you know, on certain groups. And undoubtedly you find Fees Must Fall and Black First Land First doing this, saying these guys must take their property, we must kill them, we must burn them. So there's the other publication that we should be concerned about is a publication called Black Opinion.
Ooh, I've read that one.
Yeah, yeah.
It's glorious.
I mean,
they publish Jimmy Money, don't they?
Jimmy. It seems to be affiliated to Black First, Land First, all the Guptas in some way. A lot of ANN7 people post on there.
Well, this is something worth pointing out, right? Is that, you know, this organization that seems revolutionary seems to step into the fray in battles that are odd, right? So, you know, when there's these anti-Zuma protests, which are outside the Gupta house, who's there? Black First, Land First. And they're saying, save President Zuma. They're chanting, one settler, one bullet. And they're, you know, actively being used as pawns in this game, you know. And there's a view that they're being funded by the Guptas, you know, because it's very useful to have these guys.
Well, that's proven. The Bell Pottinger report for the strategy for the Guptas was leaked. And Black First, Land First is named in it. But here's the thing, Mark. I mean, I'm against hate speech being a crime in general. And I've got no personal problem with Lindsay Marsop saying, it'd be nice to kill a white person. I want to achieve this. The problem I have in this country is that when I respond to that, other people that aren't Lindsay Marsdorp say, you're a white guy, of course you feel fragile. That is the problem, in my opinion.
So I think this is an underlying problem, is that we're creating a situation where certain groups of people are okay to vilify. We say, don't worry about it. You're a white man. Nothing can touch you. You know, we can say this stuff and it's fine. You know, but you can, you know, step back in history and there were other powerful groups who got vilified enough until they got, you know, pushed into ovens or chopped up by machetes. It's dangerous. So, I mean, you and I will differ on this, that I think genuine hate speech is a problem and that you need to
I think it's a problem, don't get me wrong, but when I fight back against it, liberal people tell me to shut up and say, but you're a white guy, of course you would think this is a problem, even though they would disagree with the original speech of someone saying kill white people.
Are you talking to the double standard?
Well, it's a double standard, but I can't respond to that hate speech.
Yeah, that's outrageous, of course.
You know? Yes.
And I think part of the problem is this idea underlying it, that the racial identity matters when we look at the speech. Now, that's an outrageous idea. We need to look at the speech and say, is this hate speech or not? Who is it targeting? Yes. The person saying it, I think what you might care about some sort of power thing is it someone in the middle of nowhere? Is it someone who has a dominant position in society, some elected official? That matters. But does their race matter? You know, does their gender matter? No. You know, the idea that you get more license or more authority on the grounds of your race, that seems repugnant to me.
And especially when calling for violence.
Yes.
Okay, just let's go further down the road of, you know, if we're standing on the side of, well, we think all speech should be allowed, really, and we said it on the show before, we think the hate speech provisions in the Constitution are essentially probably unconstitutional. Certainly the Equality Court might not survive a constitutional challenge.
Yeah, that's Pepuda. That's a different act from the hate speech provision.
Yeah, I understand, but we do have hate speech laws. So and you're saying, look, you do think that there is some stuff that constitutes hate speech.
Yeah.
And I think what you're saying is we're going, well, who cares if he says something unless he's standing in front of a baying mob and I'm literally next door. No, we're saying no big deal, right? And you're saying maybe it is a big deal because it leads to something.
So I'll run through this a little quickly. So our constitution sort of sets up the parameters of what's contained in the right to free speech. And we have this very big right. You know, the fact that Dayana Mabuda is protected gives an indication of that. And then it says there's three exceptions. First being no propaganda for war. Second, no incitement of imminent violence. So this is the bang mob example, right? You're in front of the mob and you're calling for something. And they're likely that they'll act. And the third provision, which is really the sort of hate speech prohibition, is this. It says, advocacy of hatred on one of four listed grounds, race, gender, ethnicity, and religion, and that constitutes incitement to harm. Now, you'll notice the imminency bit has been taken away. So the idea is that you don't need to be standing in front of the baying mob when you advocate hatred and call for harm to be visited upon others. So if you write it in an opinion piece or on a tweet, it's still not protected speech because there's this additional factor of advocacy of hatred. And because we come from a country where we've seen how this kind of thing can lead to genuine harm down the line. Now, it's different from saying something that's insulting to you. It's not about harming the person who's listening. It's about incitement to harm. So it's calling on third parties to say, go and get them. Get these evil, you know, blacks, Jews, whatever it is, the group that you're kind of, you know, targeting. So those are the distinctions to keep in mind. The problem with the hate speech bill is that it lowers the threshold massively. So it talks about speech that makes fun of someone. So, or that's merely insulting.
So the joke about estate agents is completely out.
Of course it is. Yeah. And that seems like a problem. And also they expand the number of grounds. So it's not just the four that I mentioned. It's 17 different grounds, including occupation and trade. So you can't make fun of politicians either. So what's hard about this question is that there's a lot of nuance, right? So on the one hand, I consider myself a free speech junkie, but I'm also really concerned about genuine acts of hate speech. And the way our constitution is designed is we say that stuff's not even contained in the right to free speech. It's a separate thing. I think there's good philosophical discussions you can have about this. You might think that some classical liberals are only going to want incitement to imminent violence as being the threshold, and other stuff they'll say we ought to allow, which is closer to the American position. They allow for a lot of hatred to be disseminated.
Yeah, it's pretty much where I stand.
And so where do you stand? Because I had an interesting discussion with someone who said the hate speech provision in the Constitution could have had a sunset clause. So they'll be in place for 25, 30 years so that we get over racial disharmony in a way. I mean, after apartheid, people just didn't stop being racist or anything like that. But just have it as a guideline just in case for 30 years so there's not a massive implosion of race relations. And then you destroy the provision in 30, 40 years' time, for example.
It's an interesting question. I suppose what's difficult is that South Africa's kind of gone through these different waves, right? And yeah. So I think if you asked South Africans 4 years ago how race relations going, they'd probably say pretty well, you know, and a lot of them still do say that. And we find that the last 2 years has been incredibly tense, and it's intense globally as well. It's an issue that's, you know, popping up in the States. So it's hard to know, you know, when would be the opportune time for certain clauses to disappear. I still take the view that you don't want to prohibit merely racist speech. I want to know those guys in my society because they're also an early warning. You know, when you've got the guys running around saying racist, homophobic, you know, horrible stuff, I want to allow that so you can counter dialogue with them and you can give them this outlet so they don't actually do anything harmful. You know, if you say you cannot say that stuff ever, unfortunately it boils over and you have genuine problems. But I'm okay with the idea of saying when you couple racism with calls to action, that we can then say that's not protected speech.
Sure.
The call to action, I think, really matters a lot.
I think that's reasonable. I think that's very, very reasonable. I mean, but I go back to my previous statement where if Lindsay Marsdorp says, I want to kill a white person, let it be so one day. And I retweet that or respond to him and say that that is abhorrent of you. And it's probably illegal, then I will get all the hate by saying, of course you'll say it as a white. I mean, the double standard in media specifically is jarring. And it's almost as if the media create the story rather than the story being created objectively by itself. So how can we prevent these stories from gaining the momentum that they have? Because we know already the ANC war room was created for this purpose, and they've succeeded. So how do we stop, especially media and journalists, from propagating even more and flaming the stories?
So it's one of the reasons why I think this Shirley Garland debacle is is a great moment, you know, and I think Maurice Roach should be incredibly proud of what he did, which is that he's popped a boil in South African media and he's letting the pus run out. And it's this moment for reflection. And I think what journalists need to do is say, hold on a sec, how did we allow this to happen? How did we not fact check a piece? How did we allow certain content to be endorsed? What are we doing? What's our role as a publication? So you have a publication like the Rational Standard that says, we don't pretend to be objective. We are biased. We are free market libertarians. We have a particular agenda, and we're going to drive that agenda as hard as we can. And don't expect anything different from us.
Well, that's what we've been saying on this podcast forever.
Yeah.
Just admit your bias.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've admitted your bias, and you said that's our role. Okay. And so Huffington Post could take that line. They say, you know, we're a left-wing organization.
The Salon.com of South Africa.
Yeah. Yeah. You can take this line, right? And you can be overt about it. But I think it's quite important not to just have, you know, political parties acting in the press. You want someone who's going to try and just give you a bland account of what occurred. So whenever I read the BBC, you know, I feel like it's such a different reading experience to reading Salon, which is just this, you know, huge amount of injected opinion into everything that's happened. You have the BBC account saying, this is what occurred, you know, and yes, here's a controversy, so-and-so says this, so-and-so says this. That kind of reporting is quite important. It must have a place. I'm not saying that's the only kind of reporting you ought to have. I think it's okay to have different opinions around. I think what you need as well is, I was speaking to a journalist yesterday saying there's a concern that the new guys coming into the newsrooms aren't journalists, they're activists. So you've got guys coming out of Fees Must Fall with a particular agenda, wanting to cover certain stories with a massive spin. And I think it's inevitable that people are going to come into a news organization with some kind of bias. What you want is an institutional structure that's strong enough to shape them, to say, these are the procedural mechanisms we have in place. When a story comes in, we fact check it. This is how we do it. We look for cross-references. We look for multiple people determining if this thing actually happened.
Isn't this just standard journalism, though? I mean, what you're describing, you know, have two sources
yes.
before you report something, fact check the story against other sort of sources as well, or other facts. This is pretty standard stuff.
I mean, there's a press code that gives you an indication of what you need to do. And you find the Huffington Post sort of posts their press code and basically admits that they didn't live up to it. There's a whole section there about not stirring racial intolerance, you know, unless you've got some good reason for publishing. So in other words, to publish a demagogue like Malema shouting racial invective at people, it's important for someone to have a transcription of that available to the public.
In the interest of the public.
But when you're stirring it up yourselves, you know, as the press, you know, then you are the story. And that's, you know, that kind of thing is, at least it seems to be out of accordance with the press code. So what you want is this institutional structure that's training journalists, saying this is, you know, this is how we do things in our newsroom. I think the problem as well is that you've got these financial pressures. It's not a well-paying job anymore. It's much cheaper to have a guy spouting opinion behind a desk instead of sending them out to cover things. And there's also this demand for constant news all the time. So you find that, you know, creating stories is a good way to keep attention.
And not only stories, creating outrage.
Yes, yeah.
Everyone loves the outrage.
No, well, I like for them creating stories, not reporting them.
Yeah.
They create the story themselves.
Yeah. And I think that's not the role of the press. You know, your role really is meant to be reporting on, you know.
Objectively as possible on what happened.
Well, there's two things. There's reporting and then there's analysis.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. Daily Maverick is analysis. It's opinion. Like Ranjini, she writes well, Stephen Curtis too. They report what happened and they analyze it and they have fun with it.
And there's a place for that, without
and
a doubt.
It's perfect. It works great. But if you're reporting that there's an accident on the highway, you're not going to state three black men died and a white woman ran away in a unicorn, right? You're just going to say, an accident on the highway, three people dead.
Being investigated.
Yeah, it's being investigated. Yeah. So there's two separate things.
Sure. And look, and you might think as well that when someone looks seemingly neutral in their reporting, that there's some kind of bias. So one of the things that is often discussed is depicting dead people, that when white people are dead, that often they're sort of shown in quite a respectful way, that they're shrouded, they're covered. Whereas when black people are shown dead, they're often, it's very explicit. You can see, you know, swarms of flies coming out of their mouth.
Yeah.
There's a question, well, if there's a double standard here, what's going on?
Yeah.
You know,
I think that
a fair comment.
Intuitively, that makes sense to me. There's far more respect shown to, for the lack of a better word, white bodies. Oh, I can't believe I said that. It's literally white bodies.
Get out of the studio.
Oh, you guys are so easy to bait.
It's literally white bodies. But that does seem to be the case, though. That, yes. I mean, that I agree is a double standard, too.
Yeah, yeah. So, look, my view is I abhor racism. I think it's important to try and do a bit of introspection and work out, is this practice, which looks seemingly neutral, actually racist? You know, I think that stuff's worth doing. The problem is you've just blown that concept out so that, you know, people just feel like, well, I could never say anything because of my race, or, you know, my mere presence is a violence, you know, white people are necessarily racist given their, you know, evil white skins. You know, that sort of stuff's really dangerous.
All right.
Collectivist identities.
Yeah.
All right, so stop being dicks to each other, please, and stop reporting on the penny sparrows of the world. Basically.
Yeah.
What do you say is the solution to reporting on someone like Penny Sparrow more than 500 times?
I think you have to ask yourself, is this thing newsworthy? Am I being used as a tool? And undoubtedly the press were used as a tool in this case. You know, they were just this fantastic path for diversion. The story itself was never newsworthy. It was a manufactured story. And then the question becomes, are we comfortable with, you know, pushing at those that are actually powerful? Those that are really dangerous, can we cover them? You know, and you find that, you know, how many anti-Gupta stories are you going to hear on ANN7, right?
Yeah, well, none.
Yeah, but that's why I respect ANN7 far more than other publications.
Just, you might want to expand on that slightly, but I get it.
Well, their bias is so bloody obvious, isn't it? Come on.
Yeah, their bias is so obvious, it's just, I think the issue is that they just, talking nonsense, a lot of the complete nonsense. It's not even like we're reporting what happened in a way as favorable as possible to the Guptas. It's we're just going to report absolute rubbish, or, you know, we'll get Chelsea to go onto Twitter and say how Putin is the savior of Earth.
Do you know Chelsea Lotz?
Have you seen this woman?
I'm hoping there's a Morris root behind Chelsea Lutz. It's just so blatantly outrageous.
Well, it is. It is a bit of Poe's law going on.
Socialism just means sharing and caring for all.
She's like South Africa's Godfrey Elfwick, but she basically is real.
But she believes what she says.
Yeah, I know. Chelsea is...
And Chelsea, if you're listening, this is the most airtime you're ever going to get, so don't get used to it.
Well... I don't know. She gets airtime on ANN7.
Well, no, I mean, I'm talking about the show. This is a respectable show.
Are we not having Chelsea to the studio?
No.
We don't usually limit guests.
We'll just fall for the prank.
If you're willing to have a hate monger like me on your show, you know, surely you can have this guy.
I don't know. I don't think she'd ever come on. I mean, we are
and Chelsea's latest
and
tweet.
She does love socialism.
Chelsea's latest tweet. If there's one thing that Twitter has taught me, it's how shockingly close-minded the majority of the world is.
Oh, it's too much.
Amazing.
Too much.
All right. So, okay, hate speech is a problem. I think we close the discussion, right? We're going to talk about more fun things.
Yeah. We can leave it behind. I mean, I'm still good. I disagree. You know, I'm more towards the classically liberal American version, but it's fine. It's not a big deal. I would expect to find sanction if I stood up or tweeted out on Twitter that I thought all people of X race or X sort of belief should be murdered. I would fully expect that I'm going to get into trouble for that.
No, but that's not the point, though. The point is that if someone else counters you.
Yeah, you. I know you're unhappy with a counter, but Mark's saying you even for just saying it.
But I think because it's a problem, because those people who counter that speech are vilified too. That's the biggest problem, in my opinion. I'm happy that there are dicks around, like not physical, people that spout hate speech all the time, and it's fine that they exist. But if I counter them, or if I try to ridicule them, and I'm the one being shut down by the general population on Twitter or social media.
Well, that's the nub of it for me.
Yes,
this idea of a general population on Twitter, I think, is a complete fabrication. I think what you have is you've got a whole bunch of people who hold a view very strongly, or are paid to have a view very strongly, and their job is rubbish anyone that's the enemy. So you're attacking Lindsay Marsdorp. Our job is to humiliate you, disenfranchise you, you know, make you look like a racist. That's the line, right?
Yes.
You know, I think the problem as well is Twitter's not reality, you know.
No. What?
You know, you find this with the Institute for Race Relations goes and spends time with real South Africans and does genuine polling.
Yeah.
And most of them don't think a race war's around the corner, right?
Well, no one does, except for Shaka Sisulu. And he hasn't been on Twitter like in a couple of months now.
It's odd,
ever since he's been exposed. It's very odd.
Maybe he's on an island with his 50 million.
I think it's dried up. He can't afford data. But sorry, Mark. Yes, IR has these surveys.
But what even they're finding is that those numbers are changing. You know, that there is a sort of impression in general South Africans that, you know, racial hostilities are on the rise. And part of it's being led by these guys on the fringe. So, yeah. You know, if you give every publication a bunch of extremist writers and everyone on Twitter is a lunatic, you know, that stuff starts to seep into ordinary South Africa and we start to think, well maybe we should be worried. I think the idea is not to be led by some kind of lunatic fringe.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you.
Well, you can see the danger in some way. Look, take Turkey as an example. You've got Erdogan, who has basically created an environment in which he's managed to convince his populace to an extent that it would be better to just give him all the power and to lose their democratic rights.
As Ramon would say, a benevolent dictator.
Yeah, except there's nothing benevolent about him. Nothing benevolent about him. All right, let's move on from the hate speech stuff. When are they deciding on that bill? Do we have any idea?
Submissions are in. Parliament will hopefully have some sort of open discussion about it. What's amazing about this, I have to say, is that civil society rarely came to the fore. So when the bill was initially published, the media response was, this is amazing, it's going to end racism, and you know the press was loving the bill. And once they realized, hold on a sec, this thing is going to lead to journalists being imprisoned, a whole bunch of other organizations got on board. So the Head on Citizen Foundation has written a submission. Zapiro and a group of stand-up comics have written a submission. I think there's a broad consensus in civil society this thing is very dangerous. Yeah. Religious organizations as well are very concerned because it's, you know, could end up banning religious books or banning the preaching from religious books. So if all goes well, the bill will die a death.
But that's the media in general, though, because I remember when there was the media tribunal with the secrecy bill as well. Leon Lowe wrote this fantastic column where he says the media are very happy to regulate everything else except for themselves. They are very happy. Like now they're calling for this amended FICA bill to be signed because X, Y, Z, who knows? Who the fuck are you to tell the president what bill to sign into law? Like, come on now.
I think there's a problem with media reporting on the law generally. You know, the nature of law is often it's a bit obtuse, it's complicated. Not a lot of journalists are trained in law, so they don't really know how to speak about it.
Same thing happens on medicine.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure you're regularly going to see some miracle drug that's going to save us from whatever it is, disease.
Yeah. Go,
well, actually, you know, have you done any research into this?
Or the miracle NHI program.
Yeah, sure.
It's going to cure, I don't know what's going to cure, everything. Anyway, Jonathan, what would you like to discuss?
I don't know. We were having such a good time before we started recording, and now I can't remember anything we were talking about before.
But that's because we're all naked, covered in olive oil.
It is because we're all naked, and of course the three bottles of tequila are starting to wear off.
Well, thank goodness the aircon's not on. but Mark, yes, so you actually are... No, I'm out. We're going to edit this. I don't know what to say.
We don't edit. We carry on going.
I want to say you're speaking at Free Market Foundation. When this will be released, it will be tonight.
Yes. So
this will be released on Tuesday and you're talking on Tuesday evening.
So I'll be speaking at 5:30 at the Free Market Foundation.
Right. So be there if you hear this. And this will be about the double standard that we were talking about throughout this conversation.
Yes. Yeah. And as I say, one of the things that Solidarity is going to be doing is submitting an early warning report to the UN's Committee for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And there is this concern that we're reaching a point where we're vilifying minority groups in a manner that could lead into genuine violence. And I think we should be concerned about that. There's kind of a growing tide of this. You know, and I don't think that I'm a prophet of doom.
Or a conspiracy theorist, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about this sort of stuff and sound reasonable, but I think we're reaching a point where it's important to sort of be aware of it. And what that'll mean is that the UN will have the capacity to send out a special rapporteur or recommend to South Africa that they do internal investigations to find out what's going on and try and quell the situation before it boils over into something serious. You know, you don't want another Rwanda. You don't want another South African xenophobic attack. You know, we've had this in 2008, we had it in 2015. You know, this year in February, we had anti-immigrant marches. And other minority groups are being vilified too, and that's a real concern.
Do you have any faith in the UN? I mean, I'm saying that as a general question, but you've also just said, you know, they're going to send off something to the UN. It seems to me like the UN might look at it and go, how do we feel about South Africa? Where do they stand in our estimations? We quite like them. So we're not going to really investigate this. I mean, this is an organization which puts Saudi Arabia on a human rights council.
Sure.
You know, yeah. And I think Saudi Arabia at some point was also on their Women's Rights Council. So, you know, and equal sort of countries that, that are well known for either abusing human rights or equal rights in terms of genders. So do you think we can rely on them?
I think they're a point of leverage. I share, you know, some of your concerns about aspects of the UN. I think as a nation, if you care about participating in a global community, then you do care about, you know, the reactions of your peer states. And if you're being, you know, wrapped over the knuckles repeatedly, that matters. You know, I think it sort of matters on an economic level as well, that if you can, you know, if other states, you know, view you as a rogue state, they're not going to trade with you. And that matters enormously for South Africa.
Yeah. Well, economic sabotage is, we do that quite well just by ourselves, to be honest.
Yeah, I was going to say, no one's going to trade with us anyway. Yeah, we're junk status
who
now.
Cares? But Mark, back to you. Why is solidarity being involved in this? Because we had Pete Lurie on last week. We are very fond of any organization that doesn't care too much about the state and wants to self-organize.
Taking things into their own hands.
Yeah, we're very happy for any organization like that, and we support their cause. The problem is, AfriForum and Solidarity have been vilified. Maybe, now, I don't know their full history. I don't know all their positions. Maybe some of the criticism is valid against them, that they are separatists or something to that effect. I'm not too sure. I've just seen some of the criticism, and I can't verify that criticism. So why are they the ones who are busy with this report on racist hate speech in the country?
I think part of it is that they're an organization that's shown that they're not afraid of the state, that they're willing to stand up. So one of the cases that they ran in the Constitutional Court was about coloureds working in the Correctional Services Department.
Yes.
And there was the decision that no coloured person would ever be promoted beyond a certain level on the grounds that there were too many coloureds in the Western Cape and they should, you know, distribute themselves around the rest of the country. And, you know, they fought for these guys, saying this is outright racial discrimination. And so they're willing to stick up for vulnerable people. And I think they're seeing this happening here with the double standards and, you know, on the way that hateful speech is dealt with. And they want to raise the issue. And I think, you know, there's been this sort of tactic of saying, you know, well, these bunch of white Afrikaners can't be trusted. And, you know, it's just a way of vilifying them. It's, you know, it's racism, this card of racism is just being unfortunately used to delegitimize in cases where it's not fair to do so.
Yes. No, I tend to agree with you. I mean, I've got absolutely no problem with solidarity at all. I actually quite like them. But in the same sense, if Black First Land First wasn't the vitriolic Bell Potager Gupta Page stooges that they are, they didn't participate in hate speech like that, but they were like very pro black.
Yeah.
Would you be happy to help them in something similar?
Explain how they, what would they be doing?
I will say they were a civic organization group that was just like militantly pro-black, but not anti-white like they are now, for example. They just say...
Well, they could have been, I mean, the equivalent pre-94 is the PAC, really.
Yeah,
Steve Biko. It's a Bikoist sort of approach. But I think, you know, Ramon, it's difficult to imagine something now whereby they're being so kind of, you know, there's hate speech against them or they're being oppressed in some way. I mean, that's the big thing. Everyone's fighting for who's being oppressed, really, or who's somehow under the knife, you know. And that's the big debate: is who really is under the knife. You know, the argument is that you know, someone like Solidarity might go on this and say, well, the media reporting on stuff that's a racist comment from a white person is through the roof. Maybe it should be, maybe it shouldn't be. The media reporting on a black person is nowhere to be found. A black person doing the same thing, nowhere to be found. And that's their sort of issue. The other side sort of argues, well, the white folk must shut up because, for example, the white folk have all the capital.
Because 1652, Jonathan.
Yeah, okay, but let's go with the white monopoly capital argument. The white monopoly capital, they have all the access to funds. Black people are still in the majority of the poor people, and therefore that's not fair. maybe that would be somewhere where they would.
So I think it's important to, if you look at, from my understanding, what Solidarity cares about, the way that they've approached this problem is not about a, you know, rights for whites kind of thing.
Mm.
I think what they're saying is, when you have a standard, it must be a fair, universal, objective standard. You know, it's in the nature of the rule of law that everyone is treated equally before the law.
Absolutely.
And they're pointing out, well, you don't want laws that discriminate, and you want people to be treated, you know, the same for the same kinds of offenses. That's all they're doing.
Mm.
You know, they're not asserting some sort of, you know, special status for groups. That's why I think the idea that there's some group that cares about black pride is not the corollary to an organization like Solidarity.
Right.
You know, they're not a white pride organization.
Oh, no, no. I wasn't making that assertion at all. No, I wasn't. But oh, yes, I want to ask you.
We're just playing devil's advocates.
Yeah.
I mean, Solidarity, please fund us. We'll gladly take your money.
Yeah.
But
George Soros, not so much.
No. George Soros can go get stuffed. The Human Rights Commission, right? Isn't that a kangaroo court? And the Equality Court as well. That's a bullshit kangaroo nonsense court. Yes, it's there created by statute and legislation, which is clearly unconstitutional anyway. Are these the best mechanisms to deal with hate speech?
Look, I think it's... as I say, I take the view that you do want a mechanism to deal with hate speech.
Yes,
I'm concerned about Papuda because Papuda sets thresholds incorrectly. It talks about hurtful speech, and that's not what the Constitution talks about. I don't think those organizations are necessarily inherently kangaroo courts. They have the capacity to be perfectly fair. You know, the equality courts are staffed by high court judges.
Right.
And it's one of the things that I'm going to be very proud of in South Africa is that our judges tend to be independent and fair-minded. And you want to ensure that that continues. I think the problem with the Human Rights Commission is that they're a bit underfunded, that they're kind of inundated with complaints, and it's quite hard to deal with all of them fairly. One of the examples that comes out in the Solidarity Report is two instances where they impose sanctions, they impose community service sanctions. And the one guy who calls out for violence against white people gets ordered to perform 10 hours of community service. And there's a guy who, I think it's after Fikile Mbalula, after he'd, while he was still sports minister.
Matthew Tennyson.
Yeah. So yes. Matthew Tennyson, you know, says something racist and vile.
How do you remember all these people's names?
I know the white racists because there's so few of them.
So Matthew Tennyson gets ordered to perform 6 months of community service. For using a racist epithet.
Right.
Now, you might think that both of them ought to, you know, be required to do community service. It's just, it's odd that the difference in penalty is so dramatic.
Even though the offense is the same.
Well, it's not even the same because, as I say, the I think he's a school teacher in Limpopo who gets the 10 hours, was calling for violence.
The offense is not the same.
Yeah, the offense, to my mind, seems worse when you call for violence.
Well, yes, I would say.
He doesn't use a racist epithet. He doesn't talk about, like, you know, Roy Neck or hunkies or something.
Crackers.
Yeah.
I was called a cracker the other day. It's quite fun.
Really?
On Twitter. Yeah.
Is it because you taste salty?
Because I just delve out those liberal tears very often. But yes, I mean, but you see, but that's the double standard in law, not in law, in the legal system as well, though, which is very problematic. Now, how would you solve that? Because how can you change your judge's mind?
Well, look, what you find generally, at least when it comes to sentencing, is that judges are guided by prior examples.
Sure.
And it might be that, you know, the Human Rights Commission just doesn't have enough precedents to kind of look at and, you know, act consistently. That thing takes time to build up that kind of that bank. But I do think it's worth pointing out the inconsistencies. You know, and this is done all the time in the States where they say, you know, when you've got a black accused and a white accused, specifically for drug offenses,
yes,
you wind up with these very different sentences.
Sure.
That's a concern. If your system is, you know, meting out different kinds of punishment for the same thing, you need to look at that. You need to look at it in all cases.
Yeah, except when it's determined by sex. Then we don't care if the woman get off scot-free for paedophilia, which happens quite a bit, by the way.
It's an interesting double standard, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think there are a small number of cases in America with, like, an older woman teacher, you know, with a younger student, and people's reactions seem to be different.
Yeah, it's like, oh, what a player. You're just a 13-year-old student. Well done for...
Well, it's that old thing, you know, if you're a if your son comes home, your 13, 14-year-old son comes home and says he had sex with his teacher, you give him a high five, right?
Well, speak for yourself.
If you're 13, it's a joke, but your 13, 14-year-old daughter does the same thing, you fetch your shotgun type of thing. That is roughly the setup of the joke. But it's that kind of societal sort of norm, I suppose, or belief, which would have set that up. I worry about debating, well, not debating, but setting those up as if they are actual definite things, because I think they do apply sometimes. But
I know, but you can say it's a trend.
It's the same, yeah, but it's the same kind of logic SJWs will use to fight an argument of, you know, the institutionalized racism,
right? Because middle management is white.
Yeah, so I think you need to be careful of using individual cases to make something applicable to an entire society.
Yeah. So are you guys, if you're looking at the French elections coming up, and I think it's a social justice warrior, you've got this interesting problem, right? Because on the one hand, you've got this strong, independent woman. And on the other hand, you have this young, attractive white male who's having an affair with his older teacher. You know, which one do you pick?
No, but you never pick the person on the right. It's very simple. It's like... like empowered women in the media in the United States. Lauren Southern is an empowered woman in the media. Ann Coulter is an empowered woman. Kellyanne Conway is the first female ever to run a presidential campaign, a successful presidential campaign. There are a number of women, people of color. I hate that fucking term.
Just say
but there are a number of people in Trump's administration, but they don't count because their beliefs are wrong. So, and this is the thing, is that like the part of the hypocrisy of the social justice left is it doesn't count if you don't have the right beliefs. That's...
Well, you find this sort of thing happen all the time, right? So the idea is if you don't act in the way we expect you to act as a black person or a woman, if you deviate, if you show some sort of independence, you're a sellout, you're, you know, a house Negro. You know,
Theresa May is another example. Theresa May is a woman running the United Kingdom, right? She's not as hated as Thatcher. It was a different time and there was a lot of stuff happening.
Well, Thatcher had character.
Sure, I agree with that. I think Theresa May is lacking on her charisma. But the point is you've got a woman who's broken the glass ceiling, you know, the glass ceiling that doesn't exist. But she's definitely broken through it, and it doesn't count.
But this shows you how deep the patriarchy is.
Yeah.
Because these wonderful women have to go through this evil channel, you know, of being conservative so that they can succeed in a man's world. That's how bad it is because of people like you, Jonathan.
Yeah.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
And then, patriarchy.
And then you go to the others, to the Labour Party, not one woman leader. Ever.
Yeah, it's an old white man. What is it with you people? Yes, you people, and old white men. Jeremy Corbyn, Bernie Sanders, fucking get over the old white men with bad ideology. You seriously?
Yeah, if you want to start decolonizing, right?
Yeah.
You know, we should get rid of those, you know, white Jewish guys like Karl Marx from the, you know, curriculum.
Yeah, we should.
Decolonization is Marxism. If you actually read what it says.
Yeah, well, none of us are going to argue that around this table.
That's true.
Yeah,
I'm talking to people who have principle. It's difficult to troll you, I'm afraid.
You just have to troll the people who might be listening to the show for the first time.
You should have a colonial survivor come on the show. We've got a friend who lived under colonial oppression in Eastern Europe. Funny how no one ever talks about sort of Soviet colonization and the sort of terror it wreaked on people.
Well, it's just like they don't talk about slavery in the Arab world. I saw an article the other day about West African black slaves now being traded in Libya.
Yeah, for
$200. Today, in 2017. It's 2017. You know, and it just doesn't.
We should actually just create the eight worst things radar. About the Libyan slave trade. Number 10 will. No, number 10. Fuck, I missed out the joke. Number 5 will shock you. Fuck.
Yeah, you did cock that up badly. All right, should we call it? Because yeah, well, it's been an hour and you're messing
Friday
up jokes.
Evening.
Yeah.
And we do this for free. Fucking capitalism, eh? Yeah, how evil.
Yeah,
I thought Rupert was giving you all those notes. That's what that bag is.
No, but we are getting onto the helicopter parked outside after this and going to the farm for the weekend, of course. So
you're on the Oppenheimers this weekend, or am I? Everything north of the Vol River is Oppenheimer. South is Rupert.
Yeah. Very territorial like
don't you have the schedule? All white people have like the schedule for the farms.
You must get into the Dropbox.
Okay? I always mix that book up with my Elders of Protocols of Zion book. You know, it's so confusing. It's these multiple identities. Intersectionality is running me over.
That's the problem. You can't decide. White monopoly capital meets Elders of Zion. Beautiful, beautiful. And on that note, I think we should call it.
Yes, indeed. And then, Mark, well, first of all, thank you. It's a Friday. You have to go to shul or something. I don't know. Is that right? No, Jonathan?
Don't put him on the spot. Don't put him on the spot.
Bad Jews, both of you. You should be ashamed. Nevertheless, thank you, Mark.
Don't you?
Absolute pleasure.
Thank you. What?
I don't know. Don't you have some election debate to get into, you Frenchman?
No, I'm just wondering by how much Le Pen will win.
Yeah, I don't think she will, eh?
She'll fucking coin it.
You think so?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think when you do have terrorists rocking up on the Champs-Élysées...
2 days before the election.
Yeah, that could cause some problem, but...
I'm calling false flag.
Did you see all the people, just quickly, did you see all the people on Twitter as it was... You think it was false flag? But you see all the people on Twitter before anything happened. It was just like people knew that there was a shooting. There were a whole bunch of people on Twitter who were like, please let it be a white person. Literally just said that.
Yeah, like, my sources say it's a robbery. I want to see everyone else say otherwise now. Okay. His name's Ahmed, and he had an AK-47, and he shot 2 policemen.
And he came from Belgium on like a well-known terror route.
And they say, a Belgian man. Yeah, so in Belgium, you can't be a Muslim either.
Can't trust those bloody Belgians.
You can't. It's not even a real country.
Yeah.
Non-country.
Yeah. When are they going to dismantle that? Huh?
Before we say something we regret, which we never do, let's call it a day. Mark, thank you for coming in again. Thank you for being our first recurring guest.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And we'll see you soon. And next week, we speak to the founder of Greenpeace.
Yes, we do. We speak to the founder of Greenpeace. It's quite interesting. In the meantime...
Don't hype it up so much.
Well, it is quite interesting. It was quite sciencey too.
It is quite interesting.
It's phenomenal. It's spectacular. In fact, he gives you 8 reasons why you should be worried or not worried about climate change, and number 5 will shock you. Okay. If you're listening to us for the first time, please rate us on iTunes if you're using that platform. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. The Twitter account is @Renegade_Report. Thank you for listening. As always, this is the top-rated podcast on Cliff Central and across the country. CliffCentral.com.